I'm Gail Hunt, and I'm excited to bring you Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin, a rock and talk series of Cliff's Tales from the Road, a behind-the-scenes look at his rock and roll adventures right here at WCUW.
So last time, Cliff, you started to talk about how Robert Palmer wanted you to play on his record.
Yep, his record called Secrets. That's the one with Bad Case of Loving You on it. Yeah, he sent this guy, Dave Harper. I found out his name was Dave Harper later. It was a very thick Cockney accent, to come down and fetch me. Evidently, he was working for Robert at the time, but I found out later he was Traffic's road manager, which, to me, I could have picked his brain for about three eons, you know, because Traffic was, to me, Winwood and those guys. I mean, come on, you know, back to the Spencer Davis group with Steve Winwood. Wow, amazing. So anyways, we get up to the studio, Compass Point, and the record called Secrets had already been recorded. It was essentially done. Robert said, well, you know, set up and so on. I'm getting ready. And I said, what do you, you know, kind of not unlike the Alan Toussaint story, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? Right? And he looked at me and he said, play. Just play. So they put on, I think I did three cuts on that record, maybe four. They just ran the tape and had me play. I found the key and just played. Run through one and then go.
Yeah, nice.
So that was a real interesting experience, without a doubt. And Robert knew what he wanted, you know, but he wanted that spontaneous fire, if you will. Because he had heard me play on the American Standard album. And of course, Robert was on Island as well. At the time, he was living right across the street from the studio, from Compass Point. Beautiful little house. Hardworking guy. He's not with us anymore either. Which really surprised me because, well, he smoked. But all those English guys smoked like smokestacks. He worked hard. He worked real hard at trying to build his career.
Yeah, well, that was huge, the videos back then.
Well, after that, it was, Secrets was his first departure from the blue-eyed soul thing, which was like, Give Me an Inch Girl and Pressure Drop, and, you know, even Sneaking Sally Through the Alley was kind of blue-eyed soul, what we call blue-eyed soul. And then he started to deviate. It's like Doctor, Bad Case of Loving You was, you know, kind of rocky. And so from then on, he realized, maybe this is the way to go. Because I think the record after Secrets was something called Clues. And then he connected with the Power Station guys, with those two guys from Duran Duran. And Gordon Edwards produced it at the Power Station, which was an amazing sounding record. But for those of you who care about recording studios, that album, the Power Station, is the way that studio sounds. So I did a track on a Joe Cocker album later, a couple of years later, on the Cocker album called Don't Drink the Water. And that was done. We did that at the Power Station. And you can't, the room sounded the way it sounded. That like gated thing, but incredibly positive energy. And of course, the rest of it is history. Robert's Simply Irresistible and the rest of them around that time were just monsters for Robert. Yep. Really made it for him. And it was great because he paid a lot of dues and did a lot of hard work many years before that. That was the Robert Palmer episode. What happened around that time that I'm talking about now, again, this is 1980-81. Somehow I was having another conversation with Chris Blackwell, because Chris owned a house. He owned Compass Point Studios. He owned Island Records. He owned everything. He asked me about Joe. It was a very straightforward question. He said, is Joe still drinking? And I said, unlike most people at the time would say, oh, no, he's got to be fine. He's got to give it up. And I said, what do you think, Chris? Joe's never going to stop drinking. He comes from a drinking culture. Sometimes he overdoes it. But his amazing talent and ability to sing these songs the way only no one but him can sing is prevalent, and it rises above the rest of it. And lo and behold, a month later, I find out Chris signed Joe to Island. So the subsequent album then was now Sheffield Steel, which was mainly recorded with this amazing rhythm section, Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare, and a few of the people from the Talking Heads, and a great guitar player named Barry Reynolds, a keyboard player named Wally Badaroo, who they called Prophet. It was a concept. Chris produced it. It was kind of a concept record. They flew me down to record on it. So I went down and back down to Nassau, did a couple of tracks, and everybody was happy. It was really fun. And Chris pulled me aside and he said, Cliff, I really love what you did there, and I'm just ready to explode. And then he said, but I can't use it. And I said, well, why? He said, it'll take the record to a place that I don't envision. If you listen to Sheffield Steel, it had a very reggae feel, and I was rocking it. I mean, to the point, Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare, bass player and drummer, traveled with a guy named Sticky, who just played tambourine with a stick.
Nice.
Sticky was great. And that's just a little sidebar. But so it was, I went down to do it, but it didn't get on the record because Chris didn't envision it. Again, he's old school, you know, concept. It's not almost like a concept album. It'd be like, you can bring in Clapton to play on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, but Clapton's not going to play on Sgt. Pepper. You know,
sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah, you know, the guy can do it. Not that I'm Clapton. That's not the point. The point is that you play the way you play, and it makes the music and record sound the way you contribute to it and with your thing. And if the producer doesn't envision it, what your contribution is going to be, oh, there you go. You know, it didn't work out. So I was kind of crestfallen, but I didn't lose my job. I just didn't wind up on that album. And here's a great point. At the same time, we had done Up Where We Belong, which was in that movie Officer and a Gentleman. Mega ballad, monster ballad. An aside story to that was Joe would call me a lot of times in the middle of the night. Phone would ring about 3 o'clock in the morning, and Sue Ann would answer the phone, and you'd hear Joe would say, "Cliff?" yeah. All right. How are you doing, Joe? Fine. Listen, I've got a question. This song, Up Where We Belong. What do you think of it? Now, at that time, a lot of the demos came through me to go to Joe because there was a lot of junk that I didn't want to clog him up with. So the cassettes came to me, and certain ones that we both would agree to get through to him went to him. And when he asked me about Up Where We Belong, this is my really claim to fame, I said, I wouldn't do it. He said, why? I said, someone else trying to ram the arrangement of U.S. A Beautiful Down Your Throat again with a rubato piano intro and you know, this beautiful lush ballad. And Joe, to his majesty, says, I don't know. I think there's something there. Well, for those of you who don't know, Up Where We Belong won a Grammy and an Oscar. And it was a platinum single. And that's pretty serious. That's a million records. A million singles.
Wow.
I can pick them, huh? So at the same time, this record is flying up the charts. It's monstrous. And Chris Blackwell wouldn't put it on Sheffield Steel. He wouldn't even package it with Sheffield Steel. Again, it wasn't part of that vision that he had for Sheffield Steel. So that was a one album deal. After that, No More Island. And I'm not sure why, to be honest with you, but I don't think Sheffield Steel sold many, you know. It didn't sell a monstrous number of records. It was starting to build, but it didn't sell a monstrous number of records. So Up Where We Belong is a monster hit. Very, very monstrous hit. But for some strange reason, and that was on Island Records, for some strange reason, Joe is now without a label again. Enter Capitol, EMI. Now things are starting to click. I think his first Capitol record was called Civilized Man, which was a whole album that was done by a guy named Stuart Levine, who, by the way, produced Up Where We Belong. I remember around that time, he came by with this new singer that he was touting, not with the new singer, actually, but about this new singer, who he was calling simply Red. The guy's name turned out to be Mick Hucknall, that he said, this guy's going to be monstrous. Turns out he was. But Stuart Levine had made this whole record. Capitol turned down half of it. So they hired Gary Katz, who, as you know, produced Steely Dan, to do one side, and they kept another side. They kept half of Stuart Levine's record. We're getting a little deep now. For those of you, those audiophiles, I hope you're keeping score at home. But this is the point of all of these stories is this is what happens in the record business, or what can happen in the record business. Things get changed. They're constantly evolving, in some cases devolving. They're constantly, you're on the move. It was quite exciting. Because now Joe is starting to build considerable momentum in Europe. He always had a great market in Australia, and we went there a number of times. We went there, I think, a total of 5 times to Australia and New Zealand. But now the world was starting to open up for him because he proved himself a reliable, moderately risk-free commodity. So we would go to South America more. We would go to Japan and Europe. We were going to Europe all the time. But it was most fun to play what I used to call third world countries with first world addresses. And what I meant by that was like an Israel or a Greece or Portugal or south of Spain. Places where the normal big rock shows didn't go. We went. You know, like we would play a Bullring in the south of Spain. Wow. Malaga or someplace like that. These were cool gigs. So now a civilized man came out and did reasonably well. And that set the foundation for what you were referring to, which was the album that had You Can Leave Your Hat on it, called Cocker. You know, we were moving, traveling, touring the world. It was a lot of fun. You Can Leave Your Hat On was such a big hit in Italy. Again, more movie songs, right? Because that was from 9.5 weeks. Yeah. That was such a big hit in Italy. One summer of 85 or 86, we did in Italy alone, I think like 25 dates in 6 weeks or 5 weeks. I like to say I've been in more places in Italy than General Patton. Because we didn't just do, you know, the Milans and the Romes and the Florences and the Venices. We did all through Sicily, all underneath the boot, you know, Brindisi, Toronto, Lecce, Rimini. Rimini was Mussolini's summer residence. I bet you didn't know that.
I did not.
So it was, you know, again, just that was a great experience because we got to see places and get paid for it that you normally don't.
How often were you on the road at this point? Was it like, you know, a month at a time and then
yeah,
home for
it wasn't,
a month?
Yeah, we didn't, back then they still hadn't figured out that horrible touring schedule, which turned into like a year or 18 months straight with a couple of breaks. We would go for a month, come home for a month, go for a month, come home for a month, go maybe 6 weeks, come home, you know what I mean? So it was a drag to leave home, but exciting to be playing at that level and traveling that much. Keep in mind, this was the 80s, so it was before all the take your shoes off and you couldn't take a bottle of shampoo and, you know, all the TSA. You know, we could show up to get on a plane 15 minutes before the flight left. You could show up last minute. I remember one time we were touring Australia, and I commented to somebody, it might have been an officer, just, you know, security guy, not doing anything much other than keeping the peace. And I said, you know, you guys don't even have like an elaborate array of metal detectors to get on the plane. You know, he goes, well, I'll tell you, mate, if you hijack a plane in Australia, the only place you can go is Australia. he said, so really, you know, it's not like you're going to go to, you know, hijack, you know, in Paris and go to and wind up in Israel, wind up in Moscow. And no, you can only go to Australia, hijack in Sydney. Yeah. You know, you can go as far as Perth, but then it's the Indian Ocean, you know. So it was kind of funny. I remember one time they let me fly the plane. It's actually fairly simple. Flying is really simple. Landing, they say, can be touchy.
That's right.
That's why, by the way, all major airports only charge you to land. Yeah. They don't charge you to take off. Yeah. It's called landing fees. Yeah, but this roll, pitch, and yaw, you know, your hands are on the wheel, so that's pitch left and right, and then the wheel comes back and forth, that's yaw, and then your legs are on these two things that are pitch, I think. Anyways, I'm not a pilot anymore.
Well, you made it.
But they let me fly it for a little while. But I remember we were on our way once. Yeah, it was over the Pacific, and they actually let me in the cockpit. This is like TWA, and the guy says, you know, look, I said, this is really cool. I said, don't you think? And they had the radar up there, and he goes, see that, you know, that blip? He goes, we're going to go around that because that's uncomfortable. You know, it was serious thunderstorms, you know, when you cross the equator, I guess, where the temperature changes. We're roughly around 86, which was the Cocker album. And then it becomes, you know, I don't want to say redundant, but certainly looking back on it now, we were very lucky to have done it and incredibly lucky to have survived it. And I think at the time, we were just going through it, you know, another day at the office, you know, but in some cases, the office was Royal Albert Hall,
yeah. Wow.
You know. which sounds, I don't want it to sound, you know, flip or smug. Believe me, I've been incredibly lucky, absolutely.
So what was your collaboration with John Butcheraxis like?
I met John in around 1979, 80. You know, back then, you know, the whole thing is, it's such a long time ago, and to actually say it was March 4th on, you know, even Ringo doesn't know what he had for breakfast on March 4th, but some of the biographers do.
Yes.
But in any event, yeah, our manager from American Standard was also managing John at the time, and they wanted to put a band together. They asked me if I, you know, play guitar with John, which I thought, I love him. You know, I loved him then and still love him now. The band was John, myself, a guy named Derek Blevins on drums, and Chris Martin on bass. God, we had so much fun, made so much money. It was unbelievable. We actually made, at some gigs, we made as much as $6. No, it was horrible. I mean, it was a box of Ritz and a can of Alpo. Remember one time we were with him, it was like we were going to play The Rat at Kenmore Square, and we were going to get 2/3 of the door. And we went and played. The place was packed, literally packed to the rafters, and I walked out of there with $13. And I said to myself, I'm still with Joe Cocker. I'm with Joe Cocker at the time, I'd play with John when we were off the road. It was incredibly musically rewarding. John was explosive and fantastic. But at one point, he said to me, I was getting ready to go on the road, and of course they wouldn't play when I'd leave for a month. And John said, Cliff, you know, we got to continue. We got to play while you're gone, because we had to survive. And, you know, I will see you when you get back. I said, hey, I understand it totally. You know, I was off making money touring the world and then coming back and playing my dreams on the local rock and roll level with a guy like John Butcher, Axis. Oh, real quick, funny story. Remember Wolfie, you know, Wolfie Giannantis, who plays bass with pretty much every project I'm playing with now. He's also a great luthier, a guitar repair man. This guy came into the store. Guy came into the store. He said, "I heard this band the other night in Lowell. It was this Greek guy. The band was unbelievable." And Wolfie said, "A Greek guy?" And the guy went, "Yeah, John Butcherakis."
That is a Greek guy.
John Butcherakis. Anyway, so John said to me, going back to the rest of the story, we got to keep playing because we can't stop when you go on the road with Joe Cocker. I said, okay, fine. So I went out until I came back, and we're getting together, and he said, well, I got good news and bad news. I said, well, let's hear it. He goes, well, the bad news is we're going to continue as a trio. We're having a lot of fun as a trio, and we really don't want to have the fourth piece. And I said, I understand, Tony. I said, what's the good news? He said, while you were gone, we got signed. They got signed to Polydor Records. So it was a win-win all around. I had a great time with John. We still do play together every now and then. When my schedule permits, he includes me on John Butcher Access reunions. We have an absolute ball, without a doubt. It was thrilling, but we had a lot of fun. And John was just great to play with. And Chris and Derek Blevins, powerhouse drummer. Powerhouse.
And I guess who are some of the other famous or musical collaborations that you really enjoyed?
Well, not so much musical collaborations as much as meeting people who were your heroes. Because you got to remember that when I first heard Joe Cocker, it's 1968, I am a sophomore at Daugherty High School, wondering what just hit me. Little did I know that in 8 years I'd be playing with the guy. So these people were heroes of ours. I remember meeting Steve Winwood. It was incredibly awkward. It was at a little get-together at Chris Blackwell's apartment. I was with Joe in New York City. B.J. Wilson, who played on the first Joe Cocker album, Little Help from My Friends, he played on that track. He played with us in Joe Cocker's band for years, B.J. Wilson. He also played in a band that you might have heard of called Procol Harum.
Wow, yeah.
An incredible, incredible band. B.J. Wilson introduced me to Steve, and I was so tongue-tied, thinking later, there are a zillion and a half things I could have asked him about the Spencer Davis Group, about Traffic, about Blind Faith, about Keep Going. And all I could say was that I looked down at the floor, and there was a really nice pattern on the living room floor, and I looked and I said, that's a really nice floor, isn't it? What an idiot.
Did he like the floor?
He said, well, and again, these are charming. I found that the English guys, no matter how gigantic they were really down to earth and had a lot of humility. When you ran into trouble, is even trying to get close to an American rock star. Not that I cared about it, but even if I hear stories to this day that you can't get insulated and isolated and all the rest of stuff. But Steve Winwood just agreed with me. He said, yes, Cliff, that's a smashing floor. And I was like Chris Farley on that Saturday Night Live skit, where he was interviewing McCartney. Yeah. and he's just messing it up, you know. It was like that. It was wacky. Yeah. Started really hitting the road heavily in Europe, again, 80, 81. We did a gig, a festival, up in Norway with U2. And this is, U2 wasn't U2 yet. They were just U2. And they were down on the bill. It was not an arena. It was like a stadium, a small stadium up in Norway. And everybody was in the same dressing room, you know, just, which to me was made all the sense in the world. But in any event, Bono comes up to Joe, and I'm sitting there, and he's looking at Joe, and yeah, cocky, you know, because U2 originally, they were kind of punky. Mm. They were like a punk band. And Bono says to Joe, "Don't you get tired of singing You Are So Beautiful and Feeling All Right and every night?" And Joe looks him square in the eye and said, "You should be so lucky to have a hit." Because keep in mind, you two were down the bill, they, you know, but you could tell there was something there. We went out and saw him. You could tell there was something there. Anyway, here we go. Fast forward 3 years later. We're doing these, every summer we would do these incredible package tours of stadiums in Europe. Joe, who was right up there with popularity with you two, with Tina, with Foreigner, with Huey Lewis. Well, one time we're doing one of those shows, and I went and scoped out the dressing room area for Bono and Edge. They were always separated pretty much. Bono and Edge were in one dressing room, and Larry and Adam were in another. They kind of separated because they were different personalities. So I found Bono. I said, "Listen, do you remember doing this festival up in Norway years ago with Joe? I know it was in Norway." He goes, "Well, kinda." I said, "Do you remember the conversation you had with him about a hit?" And he kind of got a little bashful, and he went, "Yeah, I guess I do." And I said, "How do you feel about In the Name of Love now?" You know, because they can't not play it without going, "Nah, nah, 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 nah." You know, and he started cracking up, you know, because it's funny how the perspective, it's all perspective, turns. You know, you're young, you're a punk guy, you're a full piss and vinegar, but now it's Saint Bono. You know, and I mean, and they—I don't know if anybody out listening has ever seen you two. If you get a chance, do it. Really, truly, a great, great, great band.
I heard a rumor maybe you had lunch with somebody named Bob.
Oh, that's right. Oh yeah, Suanne could probably tell you that story better than me. Bob Dylan. He used to like to come to the rehearsals when we were rehearsing in New York City, and he'd just show up and kind of sit in the corner. A really interesting, very observing cat. You can imagine how observing he is. After the rehearsal, we were downtown, and we had to score a cab to come uptown. So, you know, I'm asking him, you know, "So what have you been doing?" He goes, "Nothing. It's a drought right now. Nobody's writing any stuff." He goes, "Even the Stones are using old tracks." You know, it was around the time of Undercover of the Night. You know, when you're talking to him, he sees all. That's what struck me about him. He sees all. But in any event, we're going uptown, and we were staying at this rock and roll hotel uptown called the Gorham, which was, in its heyday, was not unlike the Chelsea. You know, I mean, it was definitely a rock and roll hotel. You could get away with a lot of stuff there, and they didn't care. But just down the street from the Gorham was this lunch counter type small restaurant, dark wood, kind of like in Worcester. It wasn't unlike Circe's was years ago on Franklin Street. Any of you elderly people out there might remember. It was dark wood, dark leather, you know, dark naga hide seats and whatnot. It's me and my wife Sue Ann and Joe and Bob Dylan. I said, "You guys want anything to drink?" "Oh yeah, sure." So I went up to the bar, and I'm ordering from the bartender. He looks at me, he goes, "Company's kind of thick in the corner, don't you think?" Because he knew, he saw who was in the corner, Joe and Bob Dylan, right? And I said, "Yeah, please don't tell anybody." Even back then, you didn't want to call your local press agent up and come down, and they didn't want to get badgered. Kind of funny, but he was a very interesting and, like I said, observant guy. You just let him speak, you know. It wasn't a rock star thing as much as almost like being in the company of a philosopher.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
This week we're going to hear from Cliff about what it's like to be all over the world.
Culturally, every country certainly every country has its own nuances, if you will. For example, when we found out that we were in Australia when Up Where We Belong went to number one, me and our keyboard player, Larry Marshall, who's not with us anymore, a fantastic guy, and Joe were in an Abbo bar. We didn't know it.
What is that?
Aborigines.
Oh, no.
In Australia. And Joe's going, you know, hey, we're number one. And I can honestly tell you that the Aborigines in that bar could care less. Because we're in Australia, as far away from us as you can get. If you walked out your front door right now, I think I've mentioned this to you, and you turn left and I turn right, we would eventually meet in Australia. It's 12 hours ahead the day before. They could care less in that bar if Joe made number one. Now, you know, obviously people did eventually. That was very nice, but it was really kind of funny. It was like so. Talk about cultures and just the way, I mean, like, you want to talk about feeling like you're on another planet. Japan is like another planet. You know, when you go to Europe, we all, most of us in America, took a Latin-based language, either French or certainly Spanish now or Italian. They're kissing cousins, without a doubt. But in Japan, Japanese is Japanese. There's nothing that looks familiar. Absolutely not. And their culture is incredibly based on respect and place. You know, like I would now, if I'm walking into a restaurant or whatever, I would hold the door for the person behind me, be it a woman or a man, I'd hold the door for them. If there's a guy whose job is to hold that door, you don't do that. You let him do it because you're going to insult him if you do it. There's none of this. It's his job. And you just insulted him by doing his job for him, even if you meant the best thing. But I remember walking around the streets of Tokyo, and there's these vending machines, at least back then there were, that sold Sapporo beer. But they vended in like small kegs that were about as big as a football and a half. And you put 900 yen in it, and you press a button, and it this amazing guttural sound, and it spit out this gigantic keg. Remember walking back to the hotel, and I see our road crew, Rod Libby and Jim Skiathidis, and they both got like a keg each under their arm. And I'm thinking to myself, this is not going to end well. Because they're going back to the hotel to commune with those kegs. Again, you know, the cultures, getting back to that story about U2 at that festival, like we went on like midnight, you know, the sun is still up. Looking over a sea of blondes. Wow. Everybody was blonde. It was otherworldly. And you look at your watch and it's like 12:30 p.m. and the sun is up. It's not dark. Mm-hmm. You wonder like what happens in the other side of the year when it's totally dark. What do these people do? Where do they go to not commit Harry Carey? I don't know. You know, it's but every country had its own. I mean, Italy, my favorite place in the world, in the world is Sicily. Nice. The food, the weather, the just fantastic people, and of course the UK. You look at the countryside of the UK, and you say, well, I can see why they were the empire.
Nice.
And how about touring in America? Was it a lot of different cultural things?
America is truly the best country in the world. But because we're so new and really haven't had to pay our dues, look at what's happened over the last so many centuries in Europe. They've been squashed and blown up and squashed and blown up and came back and came back and squashed and blown up and came back. I mean, what's happening in the Ukraine right now is absolutely tragic and horrible. But you mark my words, you know, we'll be gone, but they'll come back. Because they understand the concept of how to live life. I mean, that's one thing that rang through to us as soon as the first time we went to Europe, how as musicians, we had like street creds. So didn't the butcher and the baker and the shoemaker. You know what I mean? The garbage man. They all had street creds. They all had cachet that they meant something in that society. In America, sometimes not so much. There's a lot of focus on mega billions, which to me is a shame. But that's the That's the upside and downside at the same time of isolation, being separated by all that water on both sides. I remember one time we were living, this is many, many years ago, late 70s again, Newton Square. We had just gotten back from South America, and the first tour we did of South America, and it was absolutely pandemonium. Just it was, the only thing I can liken it to was Beatlemania. Just insane. And I got home, and I'm walking my dog around Newton Square. And there was a guy sitting on the wall over by Newton Square that they used to do. And he said, "Hey, Cliff, how you doing?" "I'm doing pretty good, because I'm feeling pretty good about myself, because I just, you know, was one of the Beatles in South America, you know." Not really, but felt like it for sure. And I'm walking a few more steps, and he goes, this guy on the wall shouts and goes, "Hey, Cliff, you still got that band?" At that point, I went, ooh, you know, yeah. He brings you right down to earth and realize, yeah, okay, buddy, yeah. You know, you think it was really cool and it was for a minute, but don't drink the Kool-Aid because you still got that band. And I remember that vividly. And the cool thing, again, going back to the UK, the British guys, rock stars that we met over the years, everybody, U2 and Clapton and Sting, and you know, to keep going, were very down to earth. Very down to earth, as far as I was concerned.
You know? What was Joe like? Was he a buddy to be with on the road?
Yeah, I mean, it was. Joe was an absolute lovely, charming guy. I never saw him cop a diva vibe at all. Period.
Yeah.
Never. And I came to think that was just him, but I came to understand that sometimes it's what your support people put you in that make you feel uncomfortable. But if you just stay grounded, it's much better. Like even to this day, playing guitar is dots and spaces.
I heard a rumor that he gave you a shepherd's pie recipe.
He did. Yeah. We have it every is it Christmas Eve? I don't even remember. It's Christmas Eve. It's not Thanksgiving. It's Christmas Eve. Yeah, well, it was his mother's recipe. Sometimes we just talk about recipes. Talk about, because we loved, he turned me on to Indian food. And I really love Indian food. I wish there was a place I could get really good Indian food in Worcester. There may be right now, but I don't know about it. There was, every now and then an Indian restaurant pops up and then it goes away. So he turned me on to Indian food because you could imagine, right? It's just got incredible character and incredible spices and really exciting to eat, you know, as long as you don't make it too. I remember one time we were in London. I was with Howie Hirsch and he asked the guy to make it hot. He had a vindaloo and he asked the Indian guy in the restaurant to make it hot. And the guy went, "Do you want it hot?" And Howie said, "As hot as you can make it." And the guy went, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yes." So we had the meal and Howie brought home leftovers. And he had it in like a big styrofoam container. And he put it on his windowsill. And in the morning, it had melted through the styrofoam container.
My God.
It had just disintegrated the styrofoam container all over the windowsill. And probably, like, it was alien. Probably was eating through the floor. But I said, "Howie, was it?" And he said, "It was hot." Yeah, at one point we actually had favorite Indian restaurants throughout the world that we really loved to go to. There was one right in New York City. I don't know if it's still there anymore. It's called Mitali, Mitali. Really special if you're in New York City, listeners.
So your day would be get up, get fed, and then go to a gig, and then...
Well, yeah, you're forgetting the most important thing, the most disruptive thing. Well, you'd get up in London and get fed and then get to Paris somehow. It sounds really luxurious, but you're getting to Paris somehow.
So you're always on the move.
Pretty much. You didn't stay in, very rarely did we stay in one place when we're on tour for more than a day, a day and a half, because you've got to move. If we had, Joe was big enough in Australia where we did 5 days in a venue. So we were there for almost a week. But most of the time it was a day or two in a given city. So you were moving.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Where did we leave off? You know, our fearless leader's last escapade into the oblivion of the road. Let's go back to Europe for a while. I remember vividly playing in Europe, in Berlin. This is before the wall fell. We were staying in a hotel that was right next to the wall. I remember staying up half the night, because if you look left, you see Berlin lights up, you know, West Berlin, the lights are blaring, people are, music, you can see, everything was blinking and everything was alive. And you look to the right and you see East Berlin and it's black. It's dark. And every now and then there was like a, like we used to call it, the cops said, a bubblegum, like a bubblegum machine that would come, you know, you'd see a light, a cop car but would go by. And it was a vivid explanation, 24 karat color, you know, the West versus the East. And I felt so bad for the people in the East, because they could literally see the people in the West partying like crazy. It must have affected them horribly, but of course they were totally suppressed and repressed and put down. Many, many years later, we did go back to Europe for another project. And we had the advantage of going to well into East Germany. Now, this is after unification. This was after the turn of the century. So it was after unification. But we played a city called Dresden. Amazingly eye-opening, because Dresden, even though 20 years, two decades after unification, Dresden was still very gray and very bleak. And I asked the production manager, well, why? Why is this? You think they'd come into the fray? He said, well, even we Germans called Dresden the Valley of the Clueless, because the Dresden is in a bowl. And it didn't get Radio Free Europe really well. It didn't get anything that was a tease of the West. So when there was unification, their lives really didn't change that much, because they had no thing to base the promised land on, so to speak, if you will. And it was very, very telling. But because they were in this valley, they didn't get Radio Free Europe as well, and all those broadcasts back in the early 80s and mid 80s, and obviously 70s and 60s, to let the people in East Germany know, hey, there's something really cool going on in the West, you know, even though you've been told something else. To that point, around the same time, we played Yugoslavia, which was back then a country unto itself. We played Zagreb, and we played Belgrade. It was really, again, very telling. This was now 19, this is before unification, this is late 80s. And we landed at the airport, and you normally would land back then, and you'd go and find the cambio, which was like the bank, the change. You could change money, your dollars or whatever currency you had, to change into the local currency. The local currency in those years in Yugoslavia was called the dinars. And it was, so I go to the cambio, the bank at the airport, and there's no American flag. There's all the rest of the world, but there's no American flag. I'm saying, oh, wow, this is really, really interesting. So you can't change your dollars at the airport. Okay, fine. I changed some other currency into dinars. It was lira or marks or whatever. Back then, keep in mind, every country had its own, you know. Got to the hotel. We were staying at the Intercontinental Hotel in Belgrade. And there was an American flag with all the other country flag, so you could change your dollars into dinars. So we all lined up to change our dollars, because we're going to be there for a few days and we want to be able to pay the bills. The manager of the hotel comes running over screaming, stop, don't do this. We finally figured out he had said, what the point he was trying to get across was, if you promise to pay your bill in American dollars, we'll leave the hotel open for you 24/7. At that point, I looked to my bandmate, his name was Larry Marshall, and I said, well, there you go. That tells you where the USSR, where communism is going. They want the dollar, but they can't tell you until you get into a situation like this where they want that dollar. They don't want dinars. They don't want rubles. They don't want things like that. And I said, okay, so I guess at this point, it's only a matter of time because money makes the world go round, so to speak. Mm. You know, so that was a very interesting, vivid scene of things to come, without a doubt. We were touring Europe in 1986, and I believe that's when the Chernobyl disaster happened. And we're at this point, we're only couple hundred miles from Chernobyl, and nobody really knew what was going to happen, if it was going to melt down and it's going to be the end of the world. Again, in typical Russian fashion, they weren't letting out much information, and all we could get from the news services, whatever we could listen to, was, we hope the wind isn't blowing the wrong way, because all this potential radioactive smoke and cinders and all the rest of this stuff was up, getting up into the atmosphere. Eventually, I think they determined that it did blow north into Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden, but I guess time told out that it dissipated. But it was a very scary, that was a real scary time, because, you know, you're over there rocking and rolling, and in the back of your mind, it's like, well, is this the beginning of the end? Did someone really mess up? You know.
Well, how was the crowds? I mean, did they react differently, or were they just
no?
Out
the
there having
the
fun?
Crowds. Well, the funny thing about the European crowds is, they live the Europeans are great that way. They live their life, because at any given, well, there's a funny story about, we played Strasbourg, which is right on the border of France and Germany. It's right on the border. I was talking to this guy and saying, well, you know, this is really, really a cool little town. He goes, yeah, everybody in town has two flags. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, we keep a German flag and a French flag in case whatever happens, happens. We carry on, but you never know what flag you've got to fly tomorrow. This is, of course, a holdover kind of from the World War II, but even World War I. You know, the point is, they live their life. It was very, very telling. They carry on. Who knows who's, you know, the Who song, right? Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Right.
Carry on. So yeah, that was kind of the Chernobyl story into the fact that the audiences didn't change. I mean, when we played Belfast, and I expect these people to be shell-shocked. This was during the Troubles, and they were great. Some of the best audiences in the world were places where there was an element of oppression. The audiences in Israel were fantastic. And of course, we all know, you know, they're surrounded 24/7 by people who want to, you know, put an end to it. That was vivid. Well, you had asked previously about some interesting shows that happened. Here's an interesting story about one that didn't happen. It involves really a very scary time, specifically for Joe, because he got arrested and actually imprisoned in Vienna. Again, this is 87 or something around there, 1987. But we were finishing up a European tour, and the last date was scheduled to be in Vienna, Austria. And we got there a day or so early. And as usual, when there's nothing doing, I wanted to go down to the venue to see it with the production crew. And we walked in, and there wasn't any gear. And they were supposed to provide backline. Backline is amps and PA and whatnot. And there was absolute minimal of gear, certainly not enough to do the show. I came back to the hotel, went to see Michael Lang, who's Joe's manager. And I said, I have serious doubts about this, Michael. It doesn't look like there was a lot of preparation put in place. I don't know if this is really going to happen. He said, well, we'll give it another 5 or 6 hours and see if it changes. They made a few phone calls, went back to the venue. It hadn't changed. I said to Mike, went back to the hotel and said to Michael, if you want my recommendation, and in most instances, they didn't. I said, rent four Porsches, get the band in them, and drive to Germany now. Get out of Austria, because I don't see this ending well. Well, suffice to say, that night, the show did not happen. Well, we thought, okay, it just didn't happen. It wasn't our fault. They didn't provide the gear, or they didn't provide the back supporting equipment. Well, being the last alleged date of the tour, we were all leaving to go home the next morning. And we went home in like two shifts. Our road manager and the two of the background singers, keyboard player, left real early. And they went to the airport. And as far as I know, they got away clean. Now, you're going to listen to this because it gets tricky. A few hours later, myself, the crew, Howie Hirsch, are leaving. We get to the Vienna airport, and we find out, and our German production manager is with us. And we get to the Vienna airport, and we find out they tried to cancel our tickets. Well, our production manager evidently was very close friends with the vice president of operations from Lufthansa. So they got our tickets reinstated, and now here we are on the way from Vienna to Frankfurt, where we're going to pick up the TWA flight from Frankfurt to LA. Before he left the hotel that morning, our road manager gave me like $1,500. He said, if there's overage or any type of expenses, just pay it, get a receipt for it, and it's going to be fine, because I'm not going to be with you, so I can't handle that. All right, so here we are in Frankfurt. Our German production manager, everybody following me at home now? Our yes. German production manager says goodbye, auf Wiedersehen, because he's flying off to up to Hamburg, the home for him. We go to the TWA counter to check in, five or six of us. I give the guy our tickets, and he looks me in the eye and says, thank you. I said, what do you mean, thank you? He says, these tickets have been canceled. What do you want to do with what you want us to do with your luggage and equipment, guitars and stuff like that? I said, what? He said, yeah, I just got a telex from Vienna. These tickets have been canceled. You have no ticket. All right, I said, don't do anything, because I'm doing the math right away. I'm thinking $1,500 is not going to go too far. If we go back and stay at a hotel at Frankfurt, it's not going to go too far to check into a hotel. It just isn't. So I said, wait right there. I had just recently gotten what American Express called a gold card years ago. That was their thing. Now the cards are, you know, super duper for the Elon Musks of the world. But I said to the guy, don't do anything, I'll be right back. And I ran from the TWA gate all the way back out to the front of the airport. Now, you could do this in 86 because, or 87, because there was none of those drastic restrictions of security and all the rest of it. There was security, but nothing like it is now. I went to the TWA counter and said, I'd like to buy six tickets on this flight that's leaving in a couple hours from Frankfurt to New York City. And the lady looks me square in the eye and she said, how are you going to pay for those tickets? I took out my gold card and flapped it down and she went, okay. We get on the plane. We land at Kennedy, and now we find out that Joe had been arrested, and our German promoter had been arrested, and they were imprisoned in Vienna. You may say, how did that happen?
Yeah.
How that happened is, evidently the promoter of the show that didn't happen was the mayor of Vienna.
My God.
He had a bit of clout. And we had gotten out of town, thank God. We were already back in the States and home safe. But Joe literally was in in prison in Vienna. And later on, when he got out after a couple of days, but he said it was like that movie Midnight Express, where people are tapping on the walls and saying, "Who's that down at the end of the hall? You know, is that really Joe Carter?"
Oh, wow, that must have been crazy.
Oh, he said, Cliff, it was. I had nightmares for months. Wow. He eventually, there was litigation. He eventually sued and had a great settlement in Joe's favor,
yeah,
because it was false imprisonment. You know, contractually, the mayor did not do what he had to do. But it affected Joe for a long time.
That's
really
fair.
Did. But that was quite a debacle. That's a gig story about a gig that didn't happen. So there you go.
Thanks for tuning in to Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin. Tonight will be the final episode of a 13-week series we've had on WCUW that I've enjoyed immensely. Thanks, Cliff, for coming in. I hope you'll come back and tell us some stories about the new adventures you've been on. And enjoy this last episode. Thanks so much.
Well, we did, that was in the mid-80s, so we did, that was might have been 83. You know, it's funny about Saturday Night Live. Everybody thinks, oh, you just showed up at like, you know, 11 o'clock and got on stage and played. Actually, it was a week's ordeal.
Really?
Yeah. You had to show up on Tuesday. On Wednesday, it was called camera blocking. On Thursday was a rehearsal. On Friday, it was a dress rehearsal. And on Saturday, the day of the gig, there was a whole show that ran at 7:30 in front of a studio audience. And then at 11:30 was the one that hit the air. So it was live at 11:30, but you'd already done it two or three times. Yeah, we did. I remember the host was Sid Caesar. The format, I think, was a little foreign to him at the time, which was really strange because the guy really made his mark in the comedy world in live TV in the 50s. But now it was run a little bit differently. But the funny thing was that I was marveling at the fact that it really wasn't what I thought it was. It really wasn't, you know, show up on Saturday afternoon, plug in and play. They stood nothing to chance, timed everything down to the minute. And we still went long. On air, our second song, they had run over. I remember the stage manager was standing right in front of me trying to get us to stop. And I had to look him in the eye and say, "I'll stop playing when he," and I pointed to Joe, "stops singing." "I'm not going to stop just because you're off air. You still got a studio audience. You just can't do it that way."
Yeah.
Kind of funny. He wasn't happy with me. Joe was, but the stage manager wasn't. Old timers.
And you said earlier that you'd something about Solid Gold. Is that the TV show?
Again, but Solid Gold, again, it's don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain. Solid Gold was done in Hollywood. The way they put that show together was not unlike the way they put the Don Kirshner's rock concert together. They put it together with videotapes. What would happen in our case was we were on tour and we made a stop off in Hollywood, went in, and of course Joe could not lip sync. Everything had to be live vocal. He could not lip sync. It just didn't work. So what happened is we chose four tunes. Yeah, it was more than three, but not five. And what we did was you go in the afternoon and record them live. We recorded them at A&M Studios. And then they mixed it during dinner. And then at night, you went in and we mimed to our track that we just recorded, the tracks in the afternoon. And Joe sang live. And they recorded every tune, videotape, and they used them over the next 5 or 6 weeks. Once every couple of weeks. The dancers were live. The intro bumps from, like, I think it was Marilyn McCoo and Rick Dees or something like that, those would be live. But the actual playing of the songs, they put together with the bands from, they just went to the cupboard on a given week and pulled out who was going to be on the show, stuck them in, and did live bumps. It was pretty. A bump is an introduction to an act. I, again, one of these things where you look at, you saw the thing on, on TV, it wasn't what how it really happened. I remember this was my son Jeff was very, very young at the time, and he was over visiting a friend, and they were watching Solid Gold, and we were on Solid Gold, and Jeff got really upset because he thought I was only on his TV.
That is upsetting.
He was very, very upset and jealous because I was on his friend's TV as well.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
You mentioned Carnegie Hall and Sir.
Carnegie Hall was an interesting gig. Just a real snippet of that one. And there was it's a strict, strict union house. They wouldn't allow any drinks on stage. They had to be in a paper cup. So Joe was really irked by the fact that they had to pour his beer into a paper cup. He couldn't have an actual bottle of Heineken on stage. But one side story to Carnegie Hall was my mother and her boyfriend at the time took a cab from Worcester to see us play at Carnegie Hall.
Yes. In a cab home?
Must have been a cab home. We're playing and I'm seeing my mother like in the fourth row waving an American flag, little American flag. Yeah, but I found out later she took a cab because we didn't own a car, you know, a cab. Got in a cab. Can you imagine?
No.
Get in a cab with your friend and saying, well, where are you going? New York City, Carnegie Hall. This is how you get there? Well, you can either practice or take the cab. Okay.
That's right. And how about that place in London?
Royal Albert Hall?
Royal Albert.
That's an amazing place. Really, really is. The cool thing about Royal Albert Hall was the people, they sat. If you see pictures of it, there's this great audience and unbelievable balconies and box seats, you know, where, of course, the royalty had their specialty seats. But they also sat people like 10 feet in back of you. I mean, I could like reach over and have a conversation with a couple people that were sitting there to see the show from the side, back side of the stage. You know, how are you doing tonight? Oh, fine, Cliff. Oh, great. You know, it was... I said to myself, wow, this is unusual, to say the least. In the dressing rooms were right behind the stage. You went through a curtain, not even a door. You just went through a curtain. And we finished the show, and all of a sudden this curtain parts, and who comes in but Sting? And he's in tears. He says, Joe drove me to tears tonight. I said, it was that bad? He went, no. It was kind of funny.
Yeah,
you know, hi, I'm Sting. Hi, I'm Cliff. It was one of those things, or whatever.
Any more people that you met along your ways?
I think in previous episodes we've talked about, you know, I mean, you meet all kinds of characters, mm-hmm. without a doubt. Well, I remember one guy showed up. We were playing in Amsterdam, and this guy showed up, oh, just off the wall, dude. His name was Michael Chambers, and he showed up in this Rolls Royce, and he was a big fan of Joe. Joe kind of knew him, but I hadn't met him until this time, right in the lobby of this hotel, in this Rolls Royce. Every time he made his money by being the first guy to do a diagonal well. Before him, all the wells went straight down to the oil reserves. This guy figured out a way to do it diagonally. And he patented the system, I guess, and made millions. But I was marveling at his Rolls Royce and said, you want to drive it around? I said, sure. So he let me drive it with him around Amsterdam. And he had this phone in it, and I called Sue Ann from the phone.
Oh, that's cool.
From the Rolls Royce. He goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm driving around Amsterdam in a Rolls Royce right now. She said, yeah.
And what was she doing?
Well, she wasn't driving around Amsterdam in a Rolls Royce. God bless her. I said, you should be here. She said, what's it like? I said, it's kind of mushy. The suspension isn't that great. You know?
Now, that's a rock and roll story.
It is, I guess. No. You know, we had some fun.
No.
I haven't driven a Rolls Royce since, you know, so there you go. Let me just say, I really am so, so, so thankful that you've allowed me to recant these stories from many, many, many years ago, and the fun of having them, bringing them back is something that will stay with me forever. So, Gail, I can't thank you enough for allowing me this opportunity to do this.
Well, Dan and I have had a complete blast, and I think so have our listeners.
Absolutely.
You know, how many people get to do what you've done and travel the world and all these great gigs and stories? It's been wonderful to listen to.
Well, thank you. The story's not over. It's just out of print.
Well, we'll get back to you with what your next endeavors are at another time. But
we carry on.
We do. Yes. So thanks so much for doing this.
We love you all.
We love you more.